Hello and welcome to the Sydney Institute podcast. The Institute is Australia's premier current affairs forum. Every week, contemporary political, social, cultural, and economic issues are explored at the Institute through dialogue and discussion. This podcast was recorded recently at a members' forum in the city of Sydney. Thanks for listening, and for more information about the Sydney Institute, please visit www.thesydneyinstitute.com.au. We hope you enjoy this event.
Thanks for coming along tonight to the Sydney Institute, and thanks to Coors Chambers Westgarth for the use of this great facility. It's great to have Alan Tudge back at the Institute. He was here about a couple of years ago. He's well known to many of you, so I'll introduce him briefly. Educated at Melbourne University and at Harvard, mainly worked in a consultancy over the years, but also worked as a political advisor and was for a brief period deputy director of the Cape York Institute. He's been the member for Aston since 2010. He served as parliamentary secretary to both Tony Abbott and Malcolm Turnbull, and as recently was promoted as Minister for Human Services. And in this capacity tonight, Alan Tudge, last time he spoke broadly on Indigenous related matters. He's going to talk tonight on welfare reform, reducing dependency, and setting higher expectations. Minister, you're very welcome.
Well, thank you so much, Jared, for that introduction, and to thank you to Coors as well for hosting us here tonight, and to ladies and gentlemen, thank you for coming along on this beautiful sunny day, and you've got an incredible view which is going to distract you up here, but I hope that I can maintain your interest, because tonight I want to talk about something which I think is very important for the nation, and that is welfare reform, and in particular talk about the welfare obligations which are attached to welfare payments. And my arguments being that we need to set higher expectations upon people in those obligations. And because when we set higher expectations, people tend to step up to the mark. And likewise, if we set low expectations, then often people stoop down to them. My starting point, though, whenever I discuss welfare reform, is to say that, of course, one of the defining characteristics of a modern prosperous country is a strong social security safety net, so that when people are down on their luck, we can look after them. And of course, this has been a feature of Australian society for several decades now, and we should all be collectively proud that over this time that we have saved thousands of people from being hungry, from being without clothes and shelter. Today, however, the welfare system is creating problems that we never intended. And the design and structure of it has meant that for many capable working age people, welfare is no longer a safety net, but has become a destination. One in eight children is now growing up in a jobless household. And nearly 40% of those children will themselves be on welfare by the age of 20. We've got regions, as you'd be aware, where business owners struggle to find workers, often for entry-level jobs such as fruit picking or abattoirs, and at the same time will have 20% youth unemployment. We've got whole regions where as many people today receive their income from welfare as they do from a job. Of course, this has financial implications for the nation. As you might be aware, the welfare budget is now the largest component of the federal budget at about $160 billion per annum, and is growing the fastest at 6% nominal growth, which of course is faster than GDP growth, faster than CPI, and that means as a third of the budget growing at that pace, it is not fiscally sustainable. But the foundational problem is not the financial issue, but is the dependency it creates in capable people. And each of us would probably know of individuals or families who are stuck in the welfare cycle. Over time, their motivation collapses and their capabilities diminish. and the purpose and the structure and the dignity which comes from work is lost to them, and sometimes the despondency crosses over to multiple generations. Indigenous leaders have actually been the most articulate and persistent advocates of the need to address this problem. And perhaps because they see it most acutely in the remote locations. And indeed, a lot of my thinking in this space has come from my work in Indigenous communities, particularly with Noel Pearson over the last 15 years. Noel Pearson himself has been writing about the poison of welfare since his seminal essay called Our Right to Take Responsibility, published back in the year 2000. And it is an incredible essay that if you have not read, you should pull out, and resonates as much today as it did back then. And he said in that essay, as he says today, that welfare dependency explains the social crisis of his communities. He goes on to say that, and I quote, "It explains the phenomenon that even as our material conditions improved over recent decades, our social conditions deteriorated. Passive welfare kills initiative and pacifies recipients rather than invigorating them into social, political and economic action to secure a better deal for themselves and their children." It's pretty powerful stuff. But veteran land rights activist and former Australian of the Year, Gulderoi Yunupingu, who is perhaps the most respected Aboriginal leader in the Northern Territory, one of the most respected in Australia, he's even more blunt, and he states that welfare dependency ultimately kills, such as its all-pervasive power to suck the life out of individuals. But of course, the challenge is not merely one for Indigenous communities. Today we have hundreds of thousands of people right across our nation in pockets of all walks of life who are also in this situation. And here's an important point, and that is that no amount of extra welfare payments can change this situation. You know, we might look at a heavily welfare-dependent community and see impoverishment, but we could double the payments and that impoverishment would not diminish. Because ultimately, the way a person obtains income is as important as the amount of that income. Because for able individuals, self-respect, dignity, and economic empowerment ultimately increases when income is earned. Arthur Brooks, the head of the American Enterprise Institute, who is a fantastic thinker, he states this very plainly, and he says, and I quote, "The deep truth is that work, not money, is the fundamental source of dignity. Work is where we build character. Properly understood, it is the sacred practice of offering up our talents for the service of others." Policies which trap or encourage people to be welfare dependent when they could be working are consequently not moral policies. To the contrary, they remove dignity and they disempower. So the Turnbull government wants to change this equation. We want to change the incentives, we want to create better supports and ultimately provide better and improved and more fulfilling lives. And that is our core objective of our welfare reform, and that is to create better and more fulfilling lives. And our program, of course, starts on the opportunity side. And every lever as government, as you've heard probably ad nauseam, is geared towards growing the economy, because when the economy is growing, we create more jobs. And so everything that we are doing on the economic side is oriented towards that, be they company tax cuts, our innovation agenda, the free trade agreements, the infrastructure build, or whatever. And over the last 3 years already, there's 475,000 more jobs here in Australia today than there was 3 years ago. I mean, in addition, we're creating very specific opportunities for particular cohorts and particularly for younger people. And Minister Michaelia Cash, for example, is implementing what's called our PATH program, which provides 100,000 opportunities for young people to have some basic training, an internship, and then into a full-time opportunity. So it starts with opportunity, and we're creating those. But creating opportunities is necessary, it is important, but it is not sufficient. because we know that there are jobs available today in some locations, and yet we know that there are jobs available today in many locations which employers struggle to fill. And over the next few years, we estimate that there will be 100,000 more jobs, for example, in aged, disability and childcare. But if nothing changes, we know it's going to be difficult to transition people presently on welfare payments, including on carers' payments, into these roles. And so we therefore have to also reform the welfare system of payments and supports to ensure that it becomes what it's supposed to be, and that is the safety net, not the destination. We've actually studied the United Kingdom's experience, and particularly New Zealand's experience, in thinking about our welfare reform agenda. And New Zealand is doing incredible things at the moment, not just on the economic front, but also on the social policy front, and particularly in its welfare reform agenda. And a lot of our thinking has arisen from the New Zealand experience. And in essence, we've got a four-part program. And I should have said this at the start, as an old consultant, I can't help but have three or four slides for you. But I'm not going to bore you to tears with slides, but just use a couple as illustrations. But we've got a four-part program of welfare reform, which firstly, it begins with simplifying our payments system. Believe it or not, our payment system at the moment is intensely complicated. Patrick McClure has done a review of the payment system, and he has recommended a simplification of it. So instead of having what we have today, 20 payments, and believe it or not, 49 supplements, creating this hugely complex payment system, our aim is to simplify those overall payment system, not just to have a more simple structure, but in doing so also to address some of those financial disincentives to work, particularly where the welfare system comes up against the tax system, so that the financial incentives are relatively low. So our program is geared towards doing that. If I quote Noel Pearson again, he had this great metaphor for describing this problem of the lack of financial incentives for getting out of welfare and into work, and he called it the welfare pedestal. And he said it's like people are sitting up on a pedestal almost above the beginning of the staircase of economic opportunity, and so you have to step down in order to begin that climb up the staircase. And I think it's a remarkably good metaphor to think about. The complexity of the system, though, also means that there's perceived barriers to working or doing more work, because people don't understand precisely what implications they will have. And so we get a lot of feedback saying that people don't take on more work opportunities because they're worried that they're going to lose payments as a result. So that's step one of the program, if you like, is the simplification of the payments, and Minister Porter will be leading that work. The second is to invest additional resources and support for those groups in the community that we know are highly likely to have a life of dependency without intervention. And this is called the priority investment approach, which you may have heard of. Again, Christian Porter gave a cracking speech to the National Press Club a few weeks ago outlining this. And effectively, it is doing what New Zealand does and delves right into the data to work out precisely, based on the data, which cohorts of people are likely to be welfare dependent without further investment or intervention. We know, for example, that of the people who are under 18 and on welfare already, the data shows that 7% of that cohort will be on welfare payments for the rest of their lives, and that their net present value of the future liabilities of the welfare payments in aggregate is $322,000 per person. That's if you've got a person who hits the welfare, before they're aged 18 or under. So we have a fund, a $96 million fund, which we're looking for innovative ideas targeted at those particular cohorts who we know are particularly vulnerable. The third, which I'm going to get to and expand upon in a moment, is the creating higher expectations in welfare obligations. And the fourth, which again you may have heard about, is the cashless debit card, because In some troubled communities, unfortunately, too much of the welfare dollar gets spent on alcohol or on drugs or on gambling, which not only then damages the individual, but causes havoc on the broader community. So we are trialling in a couple of locations today, putting welfare payments via a cashless Visa debit card, which can be used anywhere to purchase anything, but restricts the purchase of alcohol, illicit substances, and from gambling. And it's early days, but it's already having some very good results. So this brings me now, though, back to what is their point three on that four pillar agenda for welfare reform. For most unemployed Australians, the concept of a job and the ability to provide for themselves and their families is incentive enough to want to get out of bed, to look for that job, to be hungry for it, to take the job when it is available. However, there's always going to be a few who try to avoid work or game the system. And there's others who frankly have not had any role models in their lives of people working. And consequently, for them, working is not a social norm. And so to prevent such people from falling into long-term dependency, they do need encouragement to look for work, to take a job and to hold it down. And at the moment, our expectations upon capable job seekers, as reflected in the practical application of the welfare obligations, is too low, and to the detriment of both the individual and indeed the broader community. And I'm going to provide some evidence of that in a moment. But first of all, why are expectations important in this space? They're important because we know from other policy areas that expectations are likely to be met, whether those expectations are good, bad, correct, or misguided. So Professor John Hattie, he's Australia's foremost educational academic. He makes this exact point in relation to the expectations that teachers place upon their students. And he says that high-performing schools are characterised by having high expectations, irrespective of the demographic composition of those students. We recently introduced a campaign setting the expectation that that parents must get their kids immunised. And we backed that up with a no-jab, no-pay policy. What was the result? Parents got their kids immunised at record numbers. Our road authorities, and particularly in Victoria where I'm from, now expect us to stay within the speed limit at all times. There's no excuse countenanced, and considerable non-negotiable penalties apply if we don't abide. Now, today, it's rare to see people deliberately speeding, and the road toll is consequently far lower than it was in previous decades. So what are our expectations then upon job seekers? Well, on the surface, there appears to be some stringent requirements, but in my view, it's more illusionary than real, because in the practical application, they're not consistently present. You know, to start, there are more than 400,000 capable people who are not subject to any work-related mutual obligations in exchange for their payments. 400,000. Those who are subject to obligations have what appears to be a robust set of conditions attached to their welfare payments. They're told that they must look for work and abide by a job plan that will be developed with them by their job service provider. Now, that typically means attending interviews that become available and taking jobs which are offered. It will require people to do work for the dole after 12 months, and if an individual does not meet those requirements, the concept is that a penalty will be imposed, for example, a reduction or suspension of payments. However, in practice, the data actually shows that this rarely happens. And I want to walk through an example of a person who is on Newstart who has a job interview, but they don't turn up and consequently miss that opportunity for a job interview. Now, remember that to get to this point, they've already been assessed as having the capacity to work. Now, step one is that the job active provider will check why the person who didn't turn up, will check why the person didn't turn up and whether they had a reasonable excuse. And a reasonable excuse is outlined in legislation, and there's a debate about whether those deemed reasonable excuses are indeed aligned with community expectations. we've got a concern, particularly that having drug or alcohol issues can be considered a reasonable excuse under current definitions. But nevertheless, you need to have reasonable excuse provisions. They are outlined in the legislation. So that's step one. But further, the job active provider who considered that there are no reasonable excuses can then exercise further discretion as to whether or not to actually recommend a participation failure to Centrelink. So I've got the category, as you can see, the third bar along here, the activities missed without reasonable excuse. And you'd think we should be setting pretty high expectations for that group of people. But the ESP exercises further discretion, and many do not pass it on to Centrelink that they have failed to turn up to that said job interview. If such a recommendation does get submitted to Centrelink, the officials will then call the job seeker to discuss the incident. They will check against the reasonable excuse list again, but empowered under the Social Security guidelines to take into account any other factor that they consider may have affected the job seeker's ability to comply. And under the guidelines, they're allowed to interpret broadly if the circumstances warrant it. So you then have further group of people who are then not subject to any further penalty regime. And there's going to be a certain proportion of submissions from the job active provider that are not valid because of procedural error. In the final result, according to a recent estimate, only about 4% of people who miss an activity without reasonable excuse actually face any penalty. This is of people who aren't deemed to have a reasonable excuse for not turning up to their job interview actually face a penalty. Now, let's get to the financial penalties themselves. You know, at the foundational level, there's actually two issues with the financial penalty regime, and they are the complexity of it and the immediacy of it. In the case of a person who missed the job interview, if after all the steps that I've just described are taken, Centrelink does decide that a penalty should be applied, then they will be docked a day's worth of their welfare payments. However, that penalty is only applied in a few weeks' time, removing the immediacy of action and of the consequence. And secondly, like the welfare payments themselves, the penalty system is overly complex. You know, different penalties apply for missing different types of activities, and there are multiple discretion points, waivers, triggers for comprehensive compliance assessments, and various types of financial and non-financial sanctions. In addition, I think it's arguable that the 8-week penalties that can be applied for serious failures are too onerous and act to dissuade decision-makers from swift and clear decision-making. And if a job seeker can't understand what the consequences will be for not complying with their mutual obligations, how can we expect that the compliance framework will be effective? I'll pull you up my one final graphic to give you an illustration. That's as simple as we could outline what the possible responses for non-compliance are in its simplest possible manner. Sanctions are often imposed, in addition, far too late to be effective at shaping behaviour. And even when penalties are imposed, they can be waived. Take, for instance, failure to job search. A job seeker has to fail in their job search efforts for 12 weeks before a financial sanction can be imposed. 12 weeks before any financial sanction can be imposed. When that person finally reaches that 12-week threshold, the penalty is typically an 8-week payment suspension, which, as I said, is arguably too onerous. However, all it takes to have the suspension waived and to receive full back payment is for the job seeker to call and agree to undertake some activity, such as some further training in the future, and then the cycle begins again. And in the last financial year, as a result, not a single person suffered a financial penalty for failure to job search. Many had suspensions, but all were fully backdated. Now, if the same individual overstayed a parking bay here in Sydney for probably 3 minutes, they would get a parking fine, regardless of the person's background. We insist through our parking laws that those individuals take personal responsibility. But when it comes to critical activity to place people onto a better life path, we too often, I believe, make excuses for them. Because the illustrations that I've given tonight aren't examples of high expectations, in my view, being set. On the contrary, I think they embody expectations which are miserably low. You know, why can't a person attend a job interview when they've been assessed as being capable of working and don't have a reasonable excuse? We should be insisting upon a higher standard, because if we do, we'd be telling them that, yes, you are capable of doing this, and yes, you can step up and take that opportunity. If they miss that interview, they're going to miss the opportunity to get onto a better life path with the benefit and the dignity which comes with holding down a job and participating in the broader society. I don't think we help anyone by excusing poor behaviour. In fact, I think it simply entrenches disadvantage and robs people of opportunity. Sometimes this is referred as the soft bigotry of low expectations, and we have to regret it. We have to reject it. Low expectations, as you probably know, are often masked in the language of compassion. But in fact, I think the very opposite is true. Because setting low expectations is a sign of disrespect, because we are telling them that they lack the capacity to change their own lives. That's what we are telling them when we set low expectations for people. And we should be raising them and telling them the contrary, that you can take that job, you can do that interview, and you can put your life onto a better pathway. Over the next few months, Michaela Cash, Christian Porter and I want to delve further into this and start the process of designing a new system built on higher expectations, where the standards are clear, where they are fair, and where they are high. But of course, while still accommodating the fact that life throws up unexpected events. And this is going to be a core part of our government's broader welfare reform agenda, as I'd outlined earlier. Ladies and gentlemen, I think we have to face the reality that in our desire to be a generous and caring society, we have reached a point where we have taken our good intentions too far and are now causing harm in some cases. Many unemployed people simply need a system that encourages them to have a go, supports them while they do it, and lets them know that we believe in their capability. We need a version of Obama's creed, in my view. Yes, you can, to express our belief in what people can do, not what they cannot. You know, every person assessed as having capacity to work can job search, can interview, and can take a job. And our welfare system has to be a safety net again, an enabler for these people. It should be backing people all the way to take a step up when an opportunity is available, and expect that they will. Let me conclude just by going back to the very beginning. And that is by saying again that we will always proudly have a generous social security safety net. It is a hallmark of every modern, prosperous, generous society. But in providing a fair handout in times of need, we must never lose sight of the fact that the most important assistance that we can do is the helping hand out of the system itself. Thank you very much, ladies and gentlemen.
Many thanks to the Minister for an important speech tonight. So we come to questions and discussion. We've got to the top of the hour or earlier, so there's plenty of time, and I have a microphone here. Main thing is to speak right into it, and if you're in the front row around here, don't stand in front of the camera. You concluded talking about, yes, we can, that yes, people who've been out of work can get back into work, and I think those principles are broadly supported. But what about it on the other side, on the employer side? As you know, years ago, well, probably decades ago now, there were a lot of low-skill jobs available in the state and federal public service. There don't seem to be that many of those around anymore, and it can be very difficult for an employer in a small business to take a risk on someone who has a poor record of discipline, a poor record of attending job interviews. I mean, what's the encouragement for an employer to take a risk on someone that you're hoping to get out of their welfare dependency?
Listen, I think that's a good question, Jared, and I'd started those remarks by saying that it must begin with opportunity. And it's opportunity broadly in terms of creating jobs, and opportunity specifically in some of the programs which we're putting in place. Now, I quickly mentioned the PATH program, which Michaela Cash is overseeing, and that is specifically targeted at young people and encouraging them to take a step into work. And it provides the opportunity for the employer to have, if you like, a short work experience period of 3 months to be able to assess that individual over that three-month period. In some respects, to reduce the risk associated with taking that person on. And then there is a $10,000 payment if indeed they do take that person on and hold that person down for a six-month period. So we think that will also be a mechanism which will encourage larger employers, but also smaller employers, for taking on younger people. More fundamentally, though, it's got to be about growing the economy so that there are those opportunities.
Thanks, Jared. Minister, congratulations. I don't think there's ever been a human services minister who's got such a comprehensive and articulated strategy. And I don't think any reasonable person would object to the outline you've given us, and you're going to tackle the simplification, and who knew there were 20 pages, 49 subsets. The social investment approach, brilliant, cashless debit card. Can I turn now to the higher expectations, and without being overly provocative, surely the biggest problems within your own department, how would anyone in the community, whatever their politics, object to the higher expectations? And that's new, and I think you'll win widespread support, but you have 40 or 50,000 public servants, many of whom are either cynical and disillusioned because nobody's ever bothered about compliance before despite their best efforts, and many of them, as you say, associate with compassion and think it's of right, and some of them are dullards. Minister, how are you going to address the implementation and application of the higher expectations and welfare obligations concept that I think the community will embrace?
Thanks, Peter, and I'll also acknowledge my secretary, Catherine Campbell, actually, who's here in the room. Not that I'm doing a hand pass to Catherine, but it is a very good question, and part of the issue is indeed within the Department of Human Services. Now, there are very good people who are working there. Typically, they work in that department because they do want to help people get onto a better pathway. Now, their decisions, though, are indeed governed by the legislation and by the Social Security guidelines. And those guidelines are quite broad in terms of what they specifically say should be taken into account, and they specifically ask that everything should be interpreted very broadly in terms of assessing that. So we're going to, if you like, spend more time having this discussion with the Australian public about the nature of the problem before we start delving into the deep solutions to it. And I think that we want to take the Australian public with us on this journey. I think, as you said, Peter, I think people want to support those who are down on their luck and don't have an opportunity and encourage them in doing so. And I think that they do want to see us have high expectations upon them, so that then when an opportunity is present, we do expect them to grab that opportunity.
Can I just ask you to perhaps educate, certainly me, possibly other people as well, as to what is the gap in actual income between people at entry-level positions, entry-level jobs, entry-level incomes, and the sort of welfare repayments that people are able to receive? Because if that gap's very small, then that in fact obviously robs incentive to take on full-time work. And if there is an insufficient gap, should perhaps effort be directed towards improving entry-level incomes?
It is hard to give a definitive answer to that because of the complexity of the welfare payment system, and each individual have different circumstances. Now, if you are one of the small proportion of people who are just on an unemployment benefit. It is a very low amount of money which you are living on. But most people, 75% of people who are on unemployment benefits also have at least two other supplements which go with it. It might be rent assistance, it might be other supplements which provide additional income. Now, if you have children on top of that, then you'll probably get a parenting payment which is worth a little bit more. You might get family tax benefits on top of that as well. Now, an unemployed couple with three children getting family tax benefits, they'll get in the vicinity of about $43,000 in a year of welfare payments. So I'm not saying that's a lot of money, but nor is it an insignificant amount of money. Now, I mean, I've done a lot of work in the remote Indigenous communities. I know with that amount of money, and if you're getting effectively a free house as well on top of that, there isn't a hugely strong incentive to take an opportunity, particularly if that opportunity means having to move to another location, having to enter the private housing rental market, having to probably get an entry-level job and working 8 hours a day. You're only just better off by doing that, and I've done the analysis on that. And that's what I think Noel Pearson means by the welfare pedestal. Different people face different effective marginal tax rates, though, depending on their precise situation.
Kevin, sorry.
Hang on, we're moving on. Kevin.
Minister, thanks for your outline of the issues. I have three questions. The first is, I'm not sure the universe we're talking about. Is it 400,000 people or more? But whatever the number is, it seemed to me this is going to be very labour-intensive, the case management of, if it's 400 or a larger universe.
Yeah, there's about 770,000 people on unemployment benefits. You've got then 800,000 people on the disability support pension. How many people on parenting payments? About 400,000, I think, from memory, on parenting payments. So,
okay, so it's a big universe.
So it's a significant universe.
What labour force you need to case manage the people. Secondly, in terms of reasonable refusal to work, I presume that's all subject, to AAT review, so the lawyers must have quite a good time on the formal lawyer. And the third question is a sort of micro question, but often the grooming, the appearance, the demeanour of the people seeking work is such that I'd never hire them. Hair to the shoulders and so on. What kind of intervention can you undertake to say, well, if you're going to get a job, you've got to have a reasonable appearance?
Some of those things, I think, are more difficult. The obligations at present are, of course, to job search, do the activities which are outlined in a job plan, which a employment service provider would write with you, to do an interview if one becomes available, and to take a job if one becomes available. That's ostensibly what the job plan is. Now, we've got job service providers right around the country. I noticed Sally Sinclair here, who's the head of the organisation which looks after those job service providers. Now, they're incented, if you like, with financial rewards for getting people into work. So, and they have to use whatever they believe is necessary to get people into work. Now, if you've got a motivated person, then they'll be able to encourage that person, listen, you might want to put on a better outfit, present yourself, have a nice CV, get yourself organised, and you're going to present better in that interview. I hear, though, feedback all the time, as I'm sure you do, that from employers, that you have people who do rock up to interviews who are clearly just trying to tick the box to say they've gone to the interview, because they almost make no effort at all. And, that's a greater challenge. Now, I hope that maybe this social investment approach, which is going to allow us to do some more innovative, targeted approaches at particular cohorts who we know will be long-term welfare dependent without an intervention, could pick up even on some of those things, and asking those people to lift and creating some additional support for those people.
Question next.
Hi, Minister. I just want to ask some questions around, well, a question particularly around raising expectations. I like the thinking perhaps where you were going in thinking that people have capacity, they perhaps have some interest in change, which leads me to ask, what role do you feel people have in who families and individuals who might be on welfare, maybe intergenerational dependency, what role they have in actually identifying what the problem here is in this space and coming up with solutions? I've worked a lot in co-design and co-developing solutions, so I think in the spirit of expecting more from people, it would be good to understand your thinking on what role they have in actually coming up with some solutions.
Well, conceptually, they are involved in the job plan design with the employment service provider presently. So you'll go to Centrelink to begin with. You'll get an assessment as to your capability and effectively your strength. Now, you are then asked to go to an employment service provider, a job active provider they're called now, who will sit down and do a job plan with you. Now, some of those are excellent employment service providers, and some of them are quite poor in terms of, in my view, the outcomes which they get. And that is the way that job seeker is engaged. And of course, what I'm arguing tonight is that we also, in part, engage them because of the expectations that we set as built into the mutual obligation requirements. And that is the expectations that you've got to do these things. Of course, there will be reasonable excuses because life events arise and we have to take those into account. But if those reasonable excuses aren't present, then there's got to be consequences, because we know that it's actually in your interest as much as it is in society's interest for you to step up to the mark. And we want to signal through our mutual obligations that we absolutely fundamentally believe that you've got the capability to do so. That's what I'm saying tonight. So it partly addresses your question, I know, but perhaps doesn't answer it completely.
Well, thank you, Minister. Naturally, not counting the disadvantage in Aboriginal communities, to what extent do you think that the low standards in some sections of the education system contribute to entrenched welfare dependency?
I'm sure that it does contribute a great deal, and most of my experience, I guess, in that area has been in Indigenous communities, and I've been to some places where literally teenagers can't write their name, having supposedly been in the education system for 8 or 10 years. You know, and if you're struggling to read, you're struggling to write, you're struggling to do some basic maths, then of course the road to employment is going to be so much steeper. And there are places where, frankly, the education standards are too low. I mean, it starts as also places where school attendance is at catastrophic levels. I think it's outside of Darwin, the school attendance rate in the Northern Territory is 60%. You know, only a quarter of kids are attending school often enough to learn, which is, the experts say, about 80% of the time. If you're not attending 80% of the time, then you fall behind and you never catch up. And only a quarter of kids in the NT outside of Darwin are attending 80% of the time. You know, it's a huge issue for us. And again, I use that as an illustration, the Indigenous community, but it's not an Indigenous problem per se. We just see it more acutely in the Indigenous communities. You see this problem also in other communities across Australia.
Charles.
Minister, congratulations and thanks for your time. Just two quick points. Obviously, Minister Morrison, the Treasurer, spoke at length about jobs and growth throughout the campaign, and this work is so explicitly linked with the, employment growth in the economy. Do you see, an opportunity that you have to work closer with the states in terms of cutting down issues of payroll tax and negative sort of taxes that can cut and hurt full employment when it's not necessarily the agenda? And just secondly, on the narrative that you, Minister Porter and Minister Cash, and the conversation you'll have with the community. When I did sort of economics in year 11, Welfare wasn't spoken about in income terms, but it was actually spoken about in transfer payments, and that was different. Now people talk about earning an income through welfare as it's a job, as in a salary job. I just see that as a small but yet subtle change in the narrative of what we're talking about in welfare. I'd just like to, I suppose, your take on that.
I mean, on the first one, I mean, I'm a liberal, I like lower taxes. And so if payroll taxes can be reduced, absolutely, that's a good thing. But any action that the Commonwealth takes in that regard, I'll leave to the my very capable colleague, the Treasurer, to deal with. In the second one, the language, I mean, it is... I notice that also, and it frustrates me that some people will say, you know, it's payday coming up, meaning that their income support is going to be placed into their account on that particular day, and it's not pay, it's, you know, it's income support. I get the criticism because I've been leading this, you know, point number four there, the cashless debit card. I get the criticism very publicly of people saying that, you know, how dare you tell me how to spend my money? And I sort of say, well, if you're earning a dollar, then we have no right to tell you how to spend that money. But if you're in receipt of welfare payments, then I think the provider of those welfare payments can put some conditions on those welfare dollars. And that's what we're doing. I try not to refer to it as income as such. You know, there's real income from working and there's receipt of income support payments, I guess we call them that.
Jay.
Thank you, Minister. That was very stimulating. I'm concerned about, if you like, the complexities of the departments. And what I think I'm enjoying about what you're talking about is that there's a team of you now working together, and the silos have either been demolished or they've had holes drilled in them to connect with the next silo. One of the issues is about families and in one of my other lives, as a Minister of Religion and working in a housing commission area, you know, you see that some of these dear children don't have a chance. Mm. I grew up as a housing commission kid and I decided not to live there. But a lot of people don't even have that option. And I'm wondering whether in some of the models you've looked at, I mean, everybody has an option, I shouldn't have said that, but it's very difficult for them to operate with a paradigm away from what they've been used to and what they've been taught in the family. I mean, there are places, and the organisation I ran used to do breakfast in schools. That's simply another way of saying parents are not looking after their kids. Sometimes some of us would call that child abuse or at least neglect. And I'm wondering whether in the models you've looked at, you mentioned Great Britain and New Zealand, whether you are seeing a breakthrough in the sense that communities and families are saying, this is not good enough for our children and our people and our communities. And is there a potential breakthrough that some of this and other stuff that you're doing could help with?
Listen, that's a really big question that you've asked in relation to that. I suppose I would refer to the New Zealand experience. And they're 5 or 6 years in advance of us of doing this social investment approach, I guess, which is deeply rooted in the data analysis. And they're already starting to get some results from what I've read and seen. I know that Bill English, the finance minister, informed me that the effectively the number of, I think it was single parents on welfare payments under the age of 20 has declined by 40%. And they're now on a better pathway. So I think that's quite a striking figure in terms of what they've done, and that is a very dedicated approach, having assessed the fact that young single parents were highly vulnerable to being welfare dependent for some time. But I think some of the broader issues you're raising go to, you know, broader societal breakdown, and which again, and I often refer back to Indigenous communities because it's acutely seen there, acutely seen, but it's not an Indigenous issue as such. It is breakdown of family, breakdown of social norms. You know, the loss of the church in some of those places, which provides, you know, the value structure, or it used to, the breakdown of respect for elders, and they're very hard things to rebuild once those social norms have broken down, And once those institutions have broken down, you know, it's why I say I'm a liberal before, but I'm, you know, I'm part of a conservative because I can see the fact that if you let these social institutions break down, then you can have all the liberalism in the world, but you'll actually won't have a healthy society.
To what extent would it be right to say that your thesis, really, if you were to be successful, would require 770,000 new jobs for the people who are presently on welfare? And is that in any sense a realistically achievable target in the foreseeable future?
That's the podcast. The suggestion is that in order for what you're saying to work, you have to have the formation of 700,000 plus jobs.
Well, unemployment at the moment is 5.7% from memory. Economists would say that, or some economists say that full employment is at 5%. Some say it's lower. We've obviously had lower unemployment here in recent years. Amongst those 700,000-odd people who are on Newstart who are job searching, the vast majority of them are only on Newstart for less than 6 months. So, but you've got a pocket there who are more entrenchedly disengaged and on longer-term welfare payments. And so that's what I'm talking about. There's constantly people who are coming in and out of the workforce, as you know. But, you know, I go back to this earlier point that I made, that there are, you know, we have this situation also that where there are pockets of Australia where the businesses can't get workers for entry-level jobs. Now, you know, we know that's the case with the fruit pickers, and we've just had a debate about the backpackers tax in relation to that. We know that's the case with some of the abattoirs who say that they can't get workers and wanted to be able to either want 457 visa holders in or perhaps backpackers to assist in terms of doing the work. But in those same locations, you might have youth unemployment of 20%. Now, that becomes a very frustrating to me, that we can have jobs on the one hand and high youth unemployment on the other, and they just aren't meeting. So your point is, of course, correct, that it starts with opportunities, but we also know that there are places already where there are opportunities and they're not being seized. And so it's opportunities and welfare reform.
Given
that I agree wholeheartedly that the number of new jobs is very important, why then are we running an immigration level that's double the long-term average? Surely, I accept the point that sometimes there are jobs and we can't fill them, but why are we continuing to run a long-term immigration policy which is twice the long-term average?
Oh, listen, I don't want to say too much on this. It's not in my portfolio area. I do know that many economists will argue that high immigration actually creates jobs in and of itself as well. You know, Australia is an immigrant nation. We're one of the great immigration nations of the world, and we have 5.7% unemployment. At the moment, it was the end of the Howard era. I think it was down to about the low fours from memory, and that was still with a very robust immigration program.
So I missed anyone on this side? I have. Okay, just pass it along, really. Quickly. Let's go. Yep.
Thank you. You mentioned that youth unemployment has gone up 20%. What effect has technology had on cutting entry-level jobs in the metropolitan areas, do you think?
Yeah, no, I didn't say that youth unemployment has gone up 20%. I think it's 12.5% at the moment. I said in some locations it's very high, and it can be up to 20%. So your question was in relation to technology taking away some of those entry-level jobs and
checkouts.
Yeah, and I think this is a broader question which we're going to have to address over the years ahead. Having said that, as I mentioned, there still are entry-level jobs in some locations which people struggle to fill.
Thank you, Minister. I'd like to go back to Peter McGoran's question. The question of the public service, and not to beat up public servants or anything, but those expectations are being placed, and rightly so, on those who are in receipt of public funds. But equally, how are you going to do with our expectation of the public service that will realise those expectations for people and help them find a way through? Because I suspect we all feel that the principle of what you talk about is right, but there is a deep and abiding concern about the politicisation of the public service in this country. And I just wonder, how are you going to handle that?
Yeah, again, it's a good question. I mean, that's when we get to the stage of laying out a broader reform agenda, of course, we'll have to think very deeply about how you implement this and how you embed it in the Centrelink network across the country. And in some cases, it will be a cultural change, and you can change culture by, of course, changing the rules. You can change the incentives in relation to that. I said before that many cases, people are just operating by the existing rules. And so they're doing the right job by the existing rules. I've also seen data, of course, where some of the results, though, vary quite markedly from one Centrelink office to another, which there might be different interpretations of the rules in different offices.
Final question. Oh,
second last question.
Thank you. Jeremy Summitt from the Centre for Independent Studies. I guess the model that we might want to look at that might work would be around the private workers' compensation and private unemployment guarantee schemes. And the difference there, of course, is that the insurers have a financial risk in somebody remaining on payments for a long time. Is there any appetite for looking at perhaps privatisation of some of these roles and the outsourcing of these skills, or to pick up the questions about the public sector?
Listen, do effectively outsource the job service provision. So in most cases, you go to Centrelink for your assessment as to your capability, but then you will go to a job service provider, whether that be managed by a not-for-profit or indeed a for-profit provider, who will do that. To your question about do we look at, insurance companies and the approach which insurance companies have, in some respects, that social investment model that I was talking about is rooted in that idea, where you're trying to work out effectively what the net present value is of the future liabilities of particular cohorts, and you're targeting those cohorts which you know are likely to be long-term welfare dependent and consequently have a very high net present value of future welfare liabilities. And in some cases, that makes you want to invest a lot more upfront to change that trajectory. So that's what New Zealand is doing. And New Zealand claim in their official statistics now that they've effectively reduced the future outlays by $12 billion, because of the interventions which they've done now. And so that very much is an actuarial approach, if you like, an insurance company approach. Where you think about, well, what are the costs and the long-term costs in present value terms, and what sort of investment, therefore, is worthwhile to reduce that long-term cost. Bill English, Bill English sort of proudly says in relation to that, that we are willing to spend as much as it requires, as long as it has the positive outcome. And he said he's been, as long as he can demonstrate that positive outcome.
You've only been in the job for less than a year, but if you were to come back in 2 years, of all the priorities you've set out today, what would you hope, above all, you've achieved? What would be the prime task out of all that?
Oh, well, Jared, there's four elements which I can't put up, but you recall the four elements of those. Now, in some respects, it's a joint exercise, across those four elements, particularly with Michaela Cash, the Employment Minister, Christian Porter, the Social Services Minister, and myself, the Human Services Minister. And to somebody's point before about the complexity of the public service, this area is particularly complex because it cuts across the three portfolios. And you have to ensure that our policies are in sync across those three portfolios to really make the system hum. But we do at the moment have three ministers who are very closely aligned in our thinking and are absolutely determined to change this trajectory. Now, I'm leading more of the work on element three, which what I've been talking about today, and element four, the, this cashless debit card. I hope that when we announce broader welfare reforms, which we will do in, at some stage in the future, that it will become a system which, of course, provides that valuable safety net, but also does provide greater incentives and encouragement and supports for people to get off welfare and into work, and that ultimately it sees more people living better and fulfilling lives because they're less likely to be trapped in the welfare cycle.
Minister, many thanks.
Thanks, Jerry.
So it's great to have Alan Touch back at the Sydney Institute. Another important address, and I'll be very brief. I think he's ideally qualified to look at this matter. If you've got a background in Boston consulting on the one hand, and you've spent some time in Indigenous communities in Australia on the other, you've got a good grasp of the whole gamut of the issue that you're looking at as a minister. So thanks for coming along tonight and giving us an important address, and good luck over the next couple of years in implementing what you're trying to do, and particularly the cashless credit card is a very important initiative, a very difficult one, but if it works, it'll have a real impact. So thank you. We'll have you back in the future, but for tonight, well done.
Yeah, thank you.
You have been listening to the Sydney Institute podcast. This podcast is proudly brought to you through the support of Microsoft Australia. We hope you enjoyed listening and can join us again soon.